content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Chris Canangla, sitting in for John Fetterson, your regular host for Indie Week for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is Indie Week. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the June 24th edition. And their lead story, Wake Election Officials Censured for Counting Ballots of Three Dead NC Voters. State Board of Elections members found the Wake officials violated their duties when they counted early ballots from voters who died before Election Day in 2024. Jerry Cohen, a member of the Wake County Board of Elections, said he cried in November 2024 when he heard family members testify about people who cast ballots before the general election but died before Election Day. Cohen, who spent decades as a top staffer in the state legislature, said Wednesday he cried again when it looked like the State Board of Elections might remove him and Greg Flynn from the Wake Board of Elections for their decision to count those dead voter ballots. The State Board did find that Cohen and Flynn violated their duties by a 3-2 party line vote, but Board Chairman Francis DeLuca, a Republican, voted with the board's Democrats to spare them from removal from the Wake Board. Instead, the State Board voted to censure them. Steve Holland of Weaverville filed a complaint challenging their count of dead voters' ballots, which he said violated a state board policy. They, quote, knowingly departed from state directives, Holland said. As a result, the ballots of three dead voters from Wake were counted in that election, while the ballots of 42 other dead voters were not. The state board's directives are written and sent to county boards to make sure that similarly situated voters are treated the same way, not just within a county, but across the state. Flynn and Cohen, both Democrats, knew what the directives required, understood that those directives governed county boards, and nevertheless voted contrary to them, Holland said. Their conduct warranted removal, he said. In January 2025, the board, then led by a Democratic majority, opted not to hold a hearing on Holland's complaint. Holland appealed to the State Board of Administrative Hearings. A judge there ruled that the board was required to hold a hearing on Holland's complaint. During Wednesday's hearing, the board, now under Republican leadership, heard testimony on the substance of the State Board memo to how to treat ballots when voters have died, whether the memo was guidance or a directive, and if the state constitution required counting those votes. Both Flynn and Cohen quoted a section of the state constitution that says, quote, every person offering to vote shall be at the time legally registered as a voter, in their argument that the ballots of deceased voters should be counted if they were properly registered. Cohen said he does not believe that any existing state law requires deceased voters' ballots to be discarded. Cohen's work for the General Assembly included drafting election laws. Cohen said the fact that lawmakers filed a bill this year to codify how the state handles early votes by people who die before an election illustrates that state law doesn't currently address the issue. Flynn said the purpose of his vote was to raise an issue that the state board or the legislator needed to address. I don't think we should be penalized for exercising our judgment, said Flynn. DeLuca asked Flynn and Cohen if they would take the same action again, and each said they would not. Cohen said he was caught up in the emotional stories from deceased voters' relatives and said he had made a mistake in voting to count their ballots. Quote, if you were to choose to reprimand me, I would accept that, Cohen said in his opening statement. If you were to want to censure me, I would stand and accept the censure as is required. But please do not remove me over this issue. Board Secretary Stacy Four Eggers IV said that it's been the law for at least the last 25 years that a voter has to be alive on Election Day for their vote to count. He voted to remove Cohen and Flynn from the Wake Board. He was joined in that vote by fellow Republican board member Angela Hawkins, who served on the Wake County Board with Cohen and Flynn during the 2024 election. DeLuca said after the meeting that he did not think Flynn and Cohen acted with malice. The numbered memos sent to county boards are confusing and should be replaced with rules, he said. DeLuca and Flynn and Cohen's testimony that they would not take the same action again influenced his vote. Said Cohen, Cohen has a long history of doing stuff in the state, not all I agree with. DeLuca said I thought he deserved the benefit of the doubt. And now another article, this one because it's Pride Month, a look at the Triangle Towns rankings on LGBTQ plus equality. Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Durham have traditionally scored high on the Human Rights Campaign's Municipal Equality Index, leaving Raleigh and Cary to play catch-up. Homebuyers can find Triangle-based realtor Jamie Ferguson on gayrealestate.com, where she is on call to help LGBTQ+ clients find somewhere to live comfortably. It can be nerve-wracking for anyone to look for their home in an unfamiliar place, and if you are queer, there can be added uncertainty when that place isn't forthright about supporting the gay community. Quote, "I am a queer woman, and I know that there are always ways to make things easier for people," Ferguson said. "For me, I'm like, okay, if I know how they feel, they don't have to tell me 90% of the story. I know it. I get it." Ferguson said some Triangle cities, like Durham, have historically been more vocal about inviting the queer community in, while others, like Cary, were seen as more conservative, only starting to make statements of acceptance in recent years. Annual scorecards from the National Nonprofit Human Rights Commission, or the HRC, provide a look at how some municipalities in the Triangle have shifted in support of LGBTQ+ equality over time. Most have improved from low ratings or remained in a high range. Ferguson said now that most of the Triangle has achieved an equitable baseline, she says queer homebuyers looking to live all over. Ferguson said her job isn't to tell people where the best place to live is if you're gay. It's to give clients the tools to figure out where they're most comfortable and find them a home wherever they want to live. There were areas that steeped out further back, and so they did in the beginning absolutely hold the flag for being where people wanted to go, Ferguson said. But now I feel like it's changed in the last 10 or 15 years, and it's everywhere. We're everywhere. Ever since 2012, the HRC issues its Municipal Equality Index, or MEI, for a number of cities across the country, assessing over 500 this past year. These cities are selected based on criteria, including size, status as a state capital, and same-sex couple population. In North Carolina, the MEI rates 10 municipalities, namely Carrboro, Cary, Chapel Hill, Charlotte, Durham, Fayetteville, Greensboro, Raleigh, Wilmington, and Winston-Salem. The index uses 49 criteria to examine how inclusive municipal laws, policies, and services are of LGBTQ+ people who live and work there. According to the HRC's website, the HRC rates municipalities based on their non-discrimination laws, employee rights, programs, law enforcement, and local leadership's positions on LGBTQ+ equality. In North Carolina's 2025 breakdown, released in November, the HRC website states that overall, North Carolina municipalities exemplified how to support LGBTQ+ individuals at the local level, even if the state legislature has enacted laws like 2023's House Bill 805, which restricted access to gender-affirming medical care for minors, overriding municipalities' ability to offer inclusive health care policies for transgender families or employees. Despite these limitations, Durham, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro have traditionally passed the MEI with flying colors, largely earning A's in the past 5 years after satisfying most of the HRC's core litmus tests, namely having non-discrimination ordinances, promoting workplace inclusivity and benefits, having LGBTQ+ liaisons and commissions, and outwardly supporting equality. In parentheses, the MEI scores cities out of 100 with flex or bonus points, allowing additional opportunities to score, but final scores cannot pass 100. The HRC does not assign explicit letter grades. In the Triangle, Durham has long been a standout. In 2021 rankings, it was the only Triangle town to score a 100 overall, while also having points for transgender-inclusive health care benefits and non-discrimination protections for housing specifically. Quote, "Durham will try things well ahead of the rest of our areas around," Ferguson said, and they did very much publicly invite the queer community years ago. Over the years, there's been a gap in the Triangle MEI scores. Wake County towns typically lag behind their Durham and Orange neighbors. From 2021 through 2024, Cary has had an F. The town crawled from a 12/100 in 2021 to a 49 out of 100 in 2024, and finally saw a big jump this year when it earned 72 out of 100, a C grade using a 10-point grading scale. Raleigh is less severe, but still somewhat low. It received a B rating, 85 out of 100 for LGBTQ plus equality this past year, but it had a D in 2021 and teetered from a C to a B in subsequent years. In 2019, Jonathan Lambert Milton was elected as the first openly LGBTQ plus city council member in Raleigh's history. He said the rubric has served as a guide to address gaps in the city services and branding identities, such as when Raleigh was the first Wake County municipality to vote to adopt the non-discrimination ordinance in 2021, or when the city worked to add an LGBTQ plus liaison in the police department, which bumped up its 2022 score. In addition to state law, Lambert Milton said that he also thinks the variation in Raleigh's score from year to year and apparent gaps in scores from city to city can depend on how the HRC itself grades, whether it's evolving wording for individual criteria, using intentionally rigorous grading, so that municipalities do not get complacent, or interpreting the way a city reports something to the HRC during the voluntary reporting process. He said these variables can lead to discrepancies in scoring, such as when having an LGBTQ plus liaison disappear from the 2022 and 2023 scorecards, despite remaining on the city's staff. He also said that services the city helps provide through grant programs and public partnerships may not be tracked as city provisions. The work is being done. I guess it's just how it's being captured and reported and scored sometimes, he said. Raleigh's Wake County neighbor, Cary, has made a comeback in recent years. Similarly as in Raleigh, Mayor Pro Tem Lori Bush said the boost from Cary's longtime F ranking to its C in 2025 came after engaging with the HRC's rubric as a framework to enact new policies, but also from responding to the HRC's voluntary survey about the unreported work they were doing. Following Raleigh's lead in 2022, Cary adopted the Wake County Non-Discrimination Ordinance, which has been a sticking point for some Wake towns, though not scored by the HRC. Holly Springs took 4 years to adopt the ordinance, and a handful of Wake's 12 municipalities still have not. Also in 2022, Cary saw new points for providing trans-inclusive health care benefits, which were later rescinded after HB 805 passed, and adding its Human Relations Inclusion and Diversity Advisory Board in 2020. Notably, the town also jumped from 0 out of 8 in 2021 to an 8 out of 8 in 2022 for local leadership on LGBTQ plus equality, which includes both city officials, public stances, and legislative efforts. In 2025, for its big push, Cary earned points for policy strides like enforcing non-discrimination in city employment. It also racked up flex points for adding programs that support LGBTQ plus youth, LGBTQ plus people experiencing homelessness, and LGBTQ plus older adults. The HRC does still identify gaps in Cary when it comes to robust non-discrimination enforcement and LGBTQ plus liaisons to the city executive and police department, despite the town having a human resources manager. "I'm proud of the progress, but we're not done," Bush said. "The next phase is about increasing our reach and the trust to make sure that the protections that we put are felt in people's daily lives. Though state limitations to LGBTQ plus rights are the be-all and end-all, the HRC provides a helpful handbook for where LGBTQ plus residents have the most non-discrimination protections and support programs, even if the scoring is flexible." Ferguson said that since the Triangle has improved its offerings overall, whether you're in Durham or Cary, community is where you make it. "Now we are a melting pot of people. It is no longer a one-tune band." All right, this next article is of particular importance if you have been affected by the federal job cuts. It's entitled, "A Year After Federal Job Cuts, Workers in the Triangle Are Still Picking Up the Pieces." Subhead, "Hundreds of Federal Workers in the Triangle Lost Jobs in the Trump Administration's Early Cuts." A year later, the future still seems uncertain. Hundreds of careers across the triangle were abruptly derailed a year ago as the federal government made sweeping cuts, offering buyouts to civil servants, eliminating grants, and dismantling organizations like the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. In the congressional district hardest hit by federal grant cuts, there's no clear way to measure the impact or where all those workers ended up, but the senses of loss is real. John Nicholson, 48, spoke to the Indy during a break from his job at Weaver Street Market in Carrboro, where he has worked since last June. In some ways, he sees it as a continuation of his 20-year career in international development, working to build a more resilient community just on a hyper-local scale rather than global. That's one of the things that I really, really like about it. Here, it was very hands-on. Of course, the jobs are vastly different, but I like that, too. Across the triangle, the federal workforce dropped by about 12% between January 25 and January 2026, according to an Indy analysis of federal job data. Hundreds more lost jobs in the private sector as federal contracts and grant dollars abruptly ended. A recent report by Axios showed that the Durham-Chapel Hill area lost about 3,800 jobs, while Raleigh-Cary grew by around 13,000 jobs, a discrepancy likely due to federal cuts. We are the brains of this country, and we're being attacked by this dumb administration, Durham Mayor Leo Williams told Indy, and we are seeing it at the dinner table. We're seeing it in the confidence of some of our most competent people. We're seeing it just trickle down and ripple through our local economy. Net job numbers give a glimpse of the impact, but the scale and nature of the cuts mean it's impossible to know exactly how many people are impacted. Lawmakers, government agencies, experts, and local chambers, no one has a hard number, but the cost is undeniable. The Indy analyzed public data and spoke to former federal workers, union leaders, advocates, and elected officials to see where the triangle's federal workers went after the cuts. Some asked not to be named, as they are still actively looking for jobs. Nicholson spent about two decades at John Snow, Inc., a Boston-based consulting firm where every one of his projects was government-funded. On his last project, he served as the Knowledge Management and Communications Director for a program helping countries digitize, share, and track health data. Nicholson knew his job might be in danger after the 2024 election. He took his family to Disney World that Christmas while he still could. On February 14, 2025, he lost his job. He's now doing some consulting again, as much as 30 hours a week, for a project out of the Netherlands, working on policy measures to improve diet and health. That's on top of a full-time job at Weaver Street, which provides insurance and gives him a chance to salvage local food for Food Not Bombs, another organization he became involved with after losing his job. Quote, it was important to me especially to demonstrate for my kids that, you know, when you get knocked down, you pick yourself back up. And it doesn't mean that you necessarily start where you left off. The scale of the cuts. At the end of January 2025, there were 8,805 federal workers in Durham, Wake, and Orange counties. About half of them work for the Veterans Health Administration. By the end of January 2026, that number had dropped 12% to 7,752. The relatively stable VA workforce, however, masks even steeper declines in other areas. The Environmental Protection Agency, for example, lost 26% of its local employees, dropping from 1,403 to 1,042. The agency's Research Triangle Park campus included a number of staff on the now-shuttered Office of Research and Development. In Durham, the immigrant rights organization Siembra NC has asked local officials to study the full impact of the cuts on the city. It actually takes me back to the pandemic, when there were folks who had never been unemployed and they would reach out to our office for assistance, said State Senator Natalie Murdoch, who represents parts of Chatham and Durham counties. In March, Murdoch visited Capitol Hill with the organization Oxfam advocating to keep funding for international aid in the budget. She was invited, she said, because North Carolina has been so deeply impacted by federal cuts. A representative of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 3347, which represents EPA employees, said that union membership has dropped from about 1,000 people to 700. The union said most of those people took buyouts rather than being laid off. Heather Hughes, president of AGFI Local 3509, which represents Social Security Administration employees in North Carolina and surrounding states, said a number of people took the offer of the Deferred Resignation Program last April, which offered the option of receiving pay for several months before departing the civil service. More followed in December. A freeze on hiring has meant those who remain are stretched even thinner. People didn't stop having babies and needing Social Security numbers and needing replacement cards, so the work increases, the staffing decreases, Hughes said. Then there's the unknown number of workers who lost their jobs when federal contracts or grants ended abruptly. Some, like Nicholson, worked for organizations based out of state, making it nearly impossible to track. One of his colleagues, who was also laid off, Kate Sheehan, 48, said that of the 20 or 30 JSI employees who worked in the Triangle, only three kept their jobs. Sheehan said her family income dropped by two-thirds after the layoff. She's only recently picked up part-time work that matches her professional background. I knew in sixth grade that I wanted to be a Peace Corps volunteer and that I wanted my career to be in public health, said Sheehan, who has a doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And so I knew that my identity was going to go through the ringer and that my mental health and everything was going to be a mess. Within a day of the layoff, she reached out to a triathlon coach determined to find some positive outlet for her passion. She completed the Wilmington Ironman last October. It literally, honestly saved me, she said. And then in the background, I applied for a lot of jobs. I started waiting tables just to make money. I'm still waiting tables at Venable in Carrboro. As of last September, cuts at Research Triangle Institute International had impacted over 400 people in North Carolina. FHI 360 in Durham filed notice of 144 layoffs, while the American Institutes of Research filed notice of 19 layoffs as a result of grants and contracts being cut. UNC Chapel Hill lost 97 federally funded projects, totaling $39.5 million. Despite efforts to move workers into different roles, 140 people were laid off as a result, a university spokesperson said. Duke University, North Carolina State University, and North Carolina Central University did not respond to requests for comment regarding the job market. Not every local federal agency has seen a mass exodus. There's about the same number of TSA workers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport as a year ago, said Mac Johnson, president of ACFI Local 449, which represents TSA staff. This is despite the emotional roller coaster of repeated government shutdowns, he said. U.S. Representative Valerie Fouché, a Democrat who represents the 4th Congressional District, said she has seen the damage of the cuts. Quote, people either don't have their calls answered, don't have their questions answered, don't have their needs met, even services that are due them because the people who perform the services are not available. So where did they go? Finding where people are now is even harder than tallying the total number of lost jobs. Unemployment rates and the total labor force have remained fairly steady, according to state data and information from the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce. In the place of hard data, everyone has anecdotes, the friends and former colleagues doing administrative work for an actuary, waiting tables, starting a travel agency, chasing the vanishingly few international development jobs available, alongside other overqualified candidates. I think it's pretty hard for people who haven't experienced it to imagine everything changing on a dime and not only losing your job, but then all of your job prospects everywhere disappearing as well, said Brianna Clark-Schwelm, executive director of North Carolina Global Health Alliance. Through public layoff notices and her own personal network, Clark-Schwelm has confirmed 625 North Carolinians who lost jobs due to USAID cuts. She declined to name any specific companies, but many of them were likely at places like Research Triangle Institute International. Still, she said, this is an undercount due to a number of people who were working remotely. All of those people were people who had committed their lives to service, had committed their lives to making the world a safer place, a healthier place, she said. Some have been able to pivot very successfully, finding research work or jobs with local governments. Some left the state or even the country. Others managed to keep a job but are now underemployed. Emily Kachetkova, 44, still works for Inclusive Development Partners, a small women-owned business with expertise in inclusion, particularly of people with disabilities, in development work. USAID funded about 90% of the company's projects. The company initially laid everyone off, then hired a few back as contractors to finish the non-USAID projects. Kochetkova still has the same title, Senior Technical Advisor and Program Manager, but she's a part-time contractor now instead of a full-time employee. She's freelanced before, but it's harder now. The consulting field and opportunities are just so much more competitive because everybody's trying to do it now, she said. People that lost their jobs, who want to stay in this work, who are passionate and skilled, they're all applying for the same small batch of independent consultancies. Some just decided it was time to retire. Nina Frankel, 67, who also employed remotely for JSI, one of several organizations she worked for, over her 30-year career in international development. In that time, she worked on reproductive health, contraception, HIV, immunization, refugee health, whatever came my way. But when she lost her job last February, she decided she was done. It was my life, and I was just going to do it until I couldn't do it anymore because I loved it so much, she said. But the idea of starting and looking for a job, and looking for a job in a sector that no longer existed, you know, it was kind of daunting, and I was of age. I could retire. In the wake of the cuts, workers have found ways to support each other. Frankel and Kochetkova both found others experiencing the same thing. It's been a really neat, supportive community, Kochetkova said. And some have pushed to be reinstated. Dr. Tom Lubin, 52, is unusual among the people let go from the EPA locally because he did not take the deferred resignation offer. After 18 years with the EPA's Office of Research and Development, he signed a protest letter in late June after hearing the division might be shuttered, which it later was. Within days of signing the letter, Lubin was placed on a 2-week administrative leave, which then stretched into months of limbo before he was officially fired last October. Quote, I just couldn't believe this, because I signed this letter at home on my couch on my phone well within my First Amendment rights that I was being fired, he said. He has appealed to the Federal Merit Systems Protection Board, and his case is ongoing. In an unattributed response to the Indy, the EPA press office said it does not comment on ongoing litigation. Last December, Lubin started a remote position as a senior research scientist at the University of Michigan, a job that lets him stay in Durham, where he and his wife have lived since 2005, but he still wants to return to the EPA. My best-case scenario is that I would be reinstated, he said. I would like to say, into my old job at EPA, but that no longer exists. Now, here's another story, quite unlike the last one, but related in the sense of budget cutting. The Chapel Hill Public Library is at risk of losing county funding. In response to a budget crunch, Orange County officials are proposing a budget cut that would wipe out $620,000 from the library over the next 2 years. In March of 2025, the Southern Branch Library in Carrboro finally opened its doors to the public after years of planning and anticipation. Prior to the opening, only two libraries existed in Orange County, located in Hillsboro and Chapel Hill, with the county's budget allocating about $620,000 to the main Chapel Hill location. A year after the Carrboro opening, county officials say it's time to shift direction, and at a May 5th meeting, proposed a budget that would eliminate its funding for the Chapel Hill Library over a 2-year phase-out. The proposed budget does not sit well with everyone. Friends of the Chapel Hill Library, a nonprofit that fundraises for the library, has launched a local campaign to advocate for the county revenue, calling on residents to voice opposition, with advocates pointing out that the proposal would cut 72% of the library's operating budget and could lead to reduced hours and services. Operating costs do not, however, include personnel costs. The funding at risk of being cut amounts to about 14.4% of the library's total budget, according to an FAQ page on the Chapel Hill Public Library, as created in response to the proposed cuts. Friends of the Chapel Hill Library president, Karen Curtin, said cuts could start with a reduction in hours and the removal of free library cards for those who live outside of the town. The operating costs are what are going to have the most immediate impact, because that's what we put into collections, funding, part-time staff, programs, Curtin said. These are the things that really impact people. To offset the costs, the town of Chapel Hill could, according to the library website, raise property taxes and charge for using meeting rooms and printers to increase revenue. The town could also reduce costs through laying off part-time staff, reducing weekend hours, or cutting its collections budget. The library currently receives $621,323 annually from the county, an allocation which would be halved beginning July 1 of this year. All funding from the county would end on July 1 of 2027. The county's current contribution makes up about 0.5% of its general fund expenditures. The town of Chapel Hill has primarily funded the library. The town provided about $3.5 million to the library last year, about 72% of the library's revenue. The county has historically given Chapel Hill money to cover Orange County residents' use of the Chapel Hill Library. A memo from the county manager reads, "But now those residents have a county facility offering robust library services." The payment was conceived during a time when the county and town were seeking interoperability. That's a good word. Since that time, the county has constructed the Southern Branch Library at the Drake Ford Building in Carrboro, the memo reads. Some Orange County and Chapel Hill residents have shared their concerns with the county. In an email to commissioners, Orange County resident Emma Tinch said the library is an essential resource for all county residents. "I have used both the Chapel Hill and Carrboro libraries, and they are complementary to each other. One is not going to be able to fulfill the functions of the other, suggesting that the existence of the Carrboro library means Orange County should no longer fund DHPL is a misunderstanding how libraries work and the populations they serve." Chapel Hill resident Alec Higgins wrote that the proposed cut would have substantial consequences for the area's primary and premier library. The Chapel Hill Public Library serves about 40% of the county's residents. The Chapel Hill Public Library offers far more extensive programming, a larger collection, and a more accessible location than the Southern Branch to Chapel Hill residents, and CHPL shares those perks with residents outside the town, Higgins wrote. "Why should Chapel Hill residents be asked to pay for our share of Orange County's libraries and fully fund our own library because a new facility was built nearby?" Commission Chair Gene Hamilton, who supports the proposal, said it is necessary given the county's budget crunch. "The county provides funding to both Orange County and Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools, the Sheriff's Office, and Public Health, among other items. The money mostly comes from property taxes." Quote, "Given where we are, with cuts in federal revenues, not getting money from the state, the county is put in a very difficult position of trying to maintain the services that we're mandated to give," Hamilton said, adding the library funding is not the only budget item she would consider cutting. Hamilton said she will look at everything to reduce the tax burden on residents, but ceasing payments to Chapel Hill's library would be a first step. In a statement to the Indy, Vice Chair Amy Fowler said the proposed budget included a number of cuts to most county departments. However, Fowler said she plans to bring an amendment to the commission to restore the funding. "I am personally a big fan of the Chapel Hill Public Library and see firsthand on a weekly basis just how much a community hub it serves. And it also seems equitable to fund library services for all Orange County citizens," Fowler wrote. The amendment would need four commissioners to vote for it, which Fowler said she is not sure will happen as the board members remain very focused on preventing a tax increase. With the cuts, Orange County residents who live outside of Chapel Hill could lose access to free library cards. Currently, Chapel Hill library cards cost $65 for anyone who lives outside of Orange County, including residents of Alamance, Caswell, Chatham, Durham, and Person counties. Curtin said the proposed cut left her quite stunned, considering the large number of Orange County residents who live in Chapel Hill. "It's a problem, and it's a big part of our budget," Curtin said. "And there are many people in the county and Chapel Hill, including those who are not residents of Chapel Hill, who are very unhappy about it." The Orange County Board of Commissioners will hold a budget public hearing and work session May 12th. It did, and it will vote on a budget in June. Okay, and here's another story of interest. You may have missed this one. This has actually been going on for a little bit now. Durham County is moving toward data center moratorium. County commissioners could vote on a moratorium as early as next month, joining the city of Durham in banning data center construction. This is an issue all over the country, but here's how it is affecting Durham. On Monday, Durham County joined a growing list of local governments looking to bring data center construction to a halt. The Durham County Board of Commissioners voted unanimously to revise the Unified Development Ordinance, known as the UDO, giving the county expanded power to lengthen the duration of a data center moratorium in the future. At the start of the public hearing, Board Chair Mike Lee reiterated that the hearing would be specific to the UDO ordinance, not a moratorium vote. The earliest the board could vote on a formal data center moratorium is at its July 13th meeting. Durham County aims to join its partners at the City of Durham, which imposed a 12-month moratorium at the June 15th City Council meeting. Residents who spoke at Monday's County Commissioners meeting rehashed comments made at City Hall last week, saying the local officials and residents needed more time to fully understand the impacts of data centers on the community, particularly the hyperscale centers proliferating around the country to power artificial intelligence software. A handful of speakers pointed to the intensive demand that data centers have on water resources at a time when the region's water supply is drying up due to widespread drought conditions. And as you know, parts of the triangle are in extreme drought conditions. Durham residents are being directed to conserve water to ensure we don't run out, said Ashley Daniels. What similar directive would be given to a data center in the event that Durham sees another season of historic drought in the future, and how would this directive be enforced? Danielle Purifoy, a lifelong resident of Durham, said that the water supply in Durham is already being strained by drought and pollutants. There are several threats to our water right now, including in my neighborhood in Old East Durham, where they're meeting as we speak about Brentag's contamination of our water, said Purifoy. We're in one of the biggest droughts in the state's history right here in our region. Lake Michie is dry, folks. Falls Lake is drying up. We have a responsibility to our water, to our future, to protect our water and soil from the development of these new data centers. Concerns over the impact of data centers, nothing new. Residents have been sounding the alarm on the environmental burden caused by data centers for over a decade. But the rising omnipresence of artificial intelligence and the increased demand for computing power driving the AI software is putting more strain on resources like water and energy. In May, hundreds of residents gathered outside the Durham County Courthouse to protest rate hikes proposed by Duke Energy, which the energy company has said it needs to modernize the power grid, among other things. But residents at that protest and at Monday's county commissioners meeting argue that data centers are a primary source of increased energy demands and that residents shouldn't be the ones on the hook for footing the bill. Data center moratoriums have become the talk of every town, city, and any other local government in the triangle, though the changes to Durham's UDO will give officials flexibility on moratoriums for any type of development that may present itself in the future. In February, Chatham County passed a one-year moratorium on data centers and cryptocurrency mining operations. 2 months later, the town of Apex followed suit, unanimously passing a one-year moratorium in the wake of a raucous public discussion over the massive 190-acre New Hill Digital Campus data center proposal that was ultimately withdrawn. Orange County also passed its own year-long moratorium. County commissioners now have a couple of weeks to put together their own moratorium before taking a vote. Quote, I think that puts us in a proper posture to move forward in the direction that we see fit as a commission, said Commissioner Stephen Valentine. I want to be on the right side of history, and I believe everyone else here does as well. Well, this next story is of, well, it's sad and it's cultural and it is part of life that people who've lived here, especially for more than one generation, going back years and years and years, will probably relate to. It is the end of the line for K&W cafeterias. They fed the South on familiarity and habit. Their closure marks the loss of more than a restaurant chain. At K&W cafeteria, you didn't order so much as continue a pattern. You knew what you were getting before you ever picked up the tray. The line moved at its own pace, slow enough to consider, fast enough to keep things moving. Fried chicken or baked, green beans or butter beans, macaroni and cheese that held its shape, a square of cornbread, maybe a slice of pie. The clientele also had its patterns, retirees who came at the same time every afternoon. church groups dressed from Sunday service, families who didn't want to wrestle with a menu. That pattern held for decades until slowly it didn't. And says the author of this article, I grew up eating at K&W like so many people across the South of my generation and the two before mine. The line, the tray, the routine, it was familiar long before I understood how it worked. Years later, I saw it from the inside, working as a private chef for the Allreds, the chain's founding family, in 2013 and 14. Founded in Winston-Salem in 1937, K&W cafeterias later expanded into South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. At its peak, it had 35 locations. Theirs was a model that, for a time, met people exactly where they were, all the way up until the last location closed its doors on December 1st, 2025. There was a kind of golden age to it, when dining out didn't need to be an experience, it needed to be reliable. People wanted familiar food that would fill them up, served in a place that felt recognizable, clean, well-lit, consistent. The choices didn't change much, and that was the point. The dining rooms carried a quiet sense of occasion without ever asking too much of you. The heavy drapes, elegant sconces, and thick patterned carpet suggested formality, even if the ritual itself was simple. Cafeterias ran on predictability, menus built for scale, recipes meant to hold, and a format that allowed people to eat well without spending much or staying long. For many, it was less about choosing what to eat and more about returning to something they already knew. The cafeterias were often located near hospitals, colleges, and military bases, places where people needed to eat regularly and without complication. But, like many southern institutions, that accessibility had limits. K&W cafeterias were segregated until after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 forced integration, a reminder that the shared space they later came to represent was not always so. Other cafeterias carried K&W's model forward, sometimes through direct lineage. J&S Cafeteria, founded by Grady Allred Jr. after he left the family business in the 1980s, operated separately but followed a familiar blueprint. CNH Cafeteria in Kernersville, started by former K&W employees, remains one of the closest approximations of what K&W once was. What held that system together wasn't just the food. It was the people who returned to it again and again, until returning became the point. K&W developed a reputation, sometimes affectionate, sometimes teasing, for their canes and walkers, a reference to the older customers who made up much of the dining room. The silent generation aged into it. Baby boomers followed. K&W adjusted where it could. In 1997, the company expanded into catering and partnered with Wake Forest Baptist Hospital, now part of Atrium Health, on a healthy heart program that introduced lighter fare. But the center of the plate didn't really shift. What began as a broadly accessible format gradually narrowed. Nothing replaced the old favorites that people came for in the first place. Working for the Allreds, I saw how the business extended well beyond the restaurants. It moved through daily life, through conversations, decisions, and routines. Nearly everyone had a role, from executive leadership to marketing, interior design, restaurant management, even cashiering. The cafeteria wasn't just where they worked, it was the family's lifeblood, an identity as much as a business, something they were expected to carry forward and protect. I was hired to cook for Vivian Allred, Grady Sr.'s wife, at what the family called The Farm, a name that sounded affectionate until you realized there really were animals out back. It was home life, not restaurant life, but only a thin boundary separated them. What I cooked there rarely looked like what we served on the line. Before working for the family, I'd cooked at institutions in Winston-Salem like Noble's Grill and Graylin Estate, where presentation mattered as much as the food itself, and taught at a health and wellness center affiliated with Wake Forest Baptist Health. That background followed me into the Allred's kitchen, but the expectations were different. I had the latitude to cook what I wanted, egg roll, wrapper lasagna, pot roasts, Parmesan, chicken patties, but the goal wasn't to impress, it was to satisfy. The meals were home-style, often with a lighter hand, shaped by Ms. Vivian's needed and what the family wanted when they gathered around her table. Recipes came from everywhere, my own, my training, sometimes from handwritten index cards pulled out for the holidays and family parties. I didn't cook cafeteria food, but the same logic applied. The food had to feel right, familiar, steady, something people could return to. Most nights the table was filled. Some weeks someone would call ahead and ask if there was enough for their branch of the family to come up to the farm for supper, and there always was. My direct bosses, Derek Huggins and Natalie Allred Smith, were part of the third generation carrying the business forward. Like everyone else in the family, they had roles whether they intended to or not. The company ran through them the same way it ran through the dining rooms, quietly and continuously. The structure extended beyond the family. K&W employed people re-entering the workforce after incarceration, as well as those in minimum security work programs. It was a system built on steadiness, on showing up, learning the rhythm, doing the work. Everything was made from scratch, the way it had always been. No shortcuts. The shift didn't happen all at once. K&W reached its peak with 35 locations in 2012. 2 years later, there were 33. By the time the company was sold in August 2022, only 11 remained. By the time it became visible, the conditions that sustained cafeterias for decades had already begun to change. The customers who built their routines around places like K&W were aging, and the next generation didn't replace them in the same way. In September 2020, K&W filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. In August of 2022, it was sold to Piccadilly Restaurants, part of Falcon Holdings. By last December, the 9 remaining locations had closed. Continuity is harder to manufacture than it is to maintain. What remains of that system still exists, but just not at the same scale. JNS Cafeteria and CNH Cafeteria may carry forward versions of the model in Asheville and Kernersville, respectively, but they function more like holdovers than successors. They serve the people who still want this kind of dining, but they don't occupy the same cultural space. For the people who grew up going to cafeterias, the details are still easy to recall. Roast beef, wet. Chicken and pastry with lima beans. Fried cod with tartar sauce and a side of Jell-O. Chopped steak with gravy. Mashed potatoes, fried okra or green beans, always a roll, often a slice of chocolate or coconut pie. One person I asked remembered chicken livers with onions once a month on Sunday afternoon. Amy O'Boyle from Winston-Salem still thinks about the chicken and dumplings, best ones I've ever eaten, she said. The combinations repeat, and so do the rituals. Sundays after church, Saturday breakfast with pancakes the size of your head, Friday nights, when a paycheck meant dinner out, weekends when no one had time to cook, lunch breaks because it was quick and cheap. I remember looking around the people in front of us to see what options were available that day. Emmy Barton and Stanley wrote to me on Facebook. Us kids would try to convince our parents that Jell-O was a solid vegetable choice, but they never bit. There was a rhythm to it and a kind of built-in care. If you were too small to carry your tray, someone would ring a bell, and an employee would come help you to your table. If you came often enough, people recognized you. Sometimes they carried the tray without being asked. For families, it was as much about affordability as routine. When K&W opened in 1937, a full meal could cost well under a dollar. 80 years later, that same logic still held. A plate of meat and sides, bread and tea could still come in around $10. It's the kind of pricing that made it possible to feed a family of five without much strain. Some turned it into a game. Who could build the cheapest plate? Another described it simply, a single mother's dream. And then there are the singular details. Jell-O, cut into neat cubes and served in glass dishes. The rectangular cod patty, later replaced with a fillet. The quiet disappointment when something changed or disappeared. But what people talk about most isn't the food. It's who they were with. Grandparents, parents, church friends, neighbors, the same table over and over again until one day it stopped. After my grandparents passed, Megan DeYoung wrote, I don't think I ever went back. K&W didn't fall in a single moment. It outlived the conditions that made it necessary. The relationship people had with it, steady, habitual, sometimes unexamined, was the same kind they have with food itself, long-term, often taken for granted until it changes. Traffic at K&W had already begun to thin by the early 2000s as dining habits shifted. By the time the pandemic hit, the erosion of their customer base was already well underway. As one former employee put it, the customers didn't leave because the food got worse. They left because they literally passed away. What remains now is mostly memory. The line, the tray, the rhythm of it. Moving forward without much thought, choosing what was always there. Now there are just fewer places left to return to. I hope you enjoyed that story as much as I did reading it to you. We're getting close to the end, but I got a few more minutes, and I'm going to try to sneak a couple more stories in. This one, it's called Dexfest. If you've never heard of it, it is a living memorial to musician Dexter Rahm Weber to feature four packed nights of music. The festival, which sprawls throughout Chapel Hill and Carborough venues, June 25th through June 28th, aims to channel the vociferous sound and spirit of the Flat Duo Jets co-founder who died in 2024. A month before Carborough musician Dex Rahm Weber's death, LePab Blue owner Mike Benson watched him perform one last time. "He started sitting down, very quiet," Benson recalled. "Then the playing got progressively louder and angrier. He was pacing up and down, barking at the walls and bar chairs, howling. People who wandered in for a casual drink had no idea what they were witnessing. I told them, 'That's Dexter Rahm Weber. Enjoy.'" Dexter Rahm Weber would have been 60 years old this summer. As a musician, Rahm Weber's fusion of rockabilly, blues, and punk was paired with a legendary stage presence that earned him cult status among the underground music scene. Rahm Weber founded the Flat Duo Jets alongside drummer Chris Crow Smith, a band that was cited by Jack White as being a powerful influence on his approach to music. He cultivated relationships with iconic punk bands like X and the Cramps and Athens legends R.E.M. and the B-52s. This weekend, musicians and artists will gather in Chapel Hill and Carborough to remember his life and legacy of Rahm Weber at the 2026 Dexfest, the second iteration of its kind. The four-day event that organizers call a living memorial kicks off Thursday. That would be Thursday tomorrow, unless you're listening to this on Friday, in which case it was yesterday, followed by the main events at the Cat's Cradle with more events and shows at Local 506 and The Cave. Friday night at the Cat's Cradle features standouts like Lenny Kaye and Friends, Pylon Reenactment Society, and Flat Do-Over Jets. Saturday, also at the Cradle, highlights rockers David Jay of Bauhaus and Love and Rockets, and Ramona and the Holy Smokes. Late night after parties at the Cave keep the energy going with local DJs. The festival's final day moves beyond performance with interactive art, shared food, and a closing gathering at Local 506. The musician M.G., founder of Dexfest, only knew Rahm Weber during the last few years of his life, but emphasizes the impression he made. "I would absolutely consider him a legend," M.G. said. "He was unapologetically authentic, but I also think he had no choice but to be authentic. He just was who he was, 100% Dex, all the time." What Rahm Weber left behind, M.G. argues, extends beyond the music itself. His success helped define the Triangle's independent music identity, inspiring others to start bands, book shows, and help build a scene that still exists today. "A really important value of mine is bringing community together," M.G. said. "Meeting your neighbors, talking to strangers, leaving your phone in the car." Michael Rank, longtime North Carolina musician and former member of Chapel Hill band Snatches of Pink, knew Rahm Weber as a teenage bandmate and as a friend. "The thing I think of with Dex is that he was a lifer. This is what he did. He was all in." Benson, who had also been friends with Rahm Bauer since high school, remembers Rahm Bauer's intensity from the beginning. "He wore cut-off black T-shirts, chicken bones around his neck, leather biker jackets, and giant pompadour hair. At Chapel Hill High School, he really stood out," Benson said. "He would flop onto the floor and do the curly shuffle while playing guitar. You just couldn't look away." As Chapel Hill and Carborough continued to change, Benson worries about what gets lost when places lose their oddballs and originals. "We need the weirdness," he said. MG agrees, though they remain hopeful. "I think we still have a town full of weirdos," they said. Music-obsessed weirdos.
Okay, I think I have time for one more article. This is from the film section, and it's entitled Filmed in Durham, a new movie about cosmic coincidences has flown under the radar. The Bull City is somewhat of a main character in the indie rom-com Everything and the Universe, streaming since last year on Amazon Prime, so why has no one heard of it? Well, let's find out. 17 minutes into the offbeat indie rom-com Everything and the Universe, a woman walks into a hotel to check in for a weekend stay. The hotel lobby is bright and airy, with a wall of glass windows near the reception desk and a cream and crimson carpet underfoot. It was here that my sister-in-law Annie, says the author of the article, watching the film last month after randomly encountering it on Amazon Prime, felt a click of recognition. She hit pause and Googled, and indeed the lobby was that of the Durham Hotel. As it turns out, Everything and the Universe, in which a man and a woman meet en route to the same wedding and realize they're both in love with the bride, was filmed largely in Durham. It's also explicitly set here, as opposed to representing an anonymous southern city. Characters argue over fries at the Federal, shop for suit jackets at Dolly's, and swivel in salon chairs at Moshi Moshi, among gathering at nearly a dozen other local spots. The movie has been streaming on Amazon and Apple TV Plus since last year, but there's been no local press about it, and when began asking around, few Durhamites knew it had been released, including some of the business owners whose spaces it actually features. Aaron Karcher owns the downtown bar Arcana, where some 20 minutes of the film is set. Everything and the Universe depicted the bar true to life, down to the tarot readings, queer clientele, and its ambiguously pronounced name, the debate whether it's Arcana or Arcana. Karcher recalled the shoot happening back in 2022, but didn't realize the movie was out, or that it was a proper feature, until I emailed her to ask her about it. She watched it almost immediately and loved it. Quote, "Nobody knows about this, and they should. It's delightful," Karcher said. "It is so Durham." Indeed, unlike the last notable film to feature a modern Bull City backdrop, the 2010 flop Main Street, which depicted Durham anachronistically as an emphysemic boondock wheezing from the collapse of the tobacco industry, Everything in the Universe has an uncanny grasp on the city in which it is set. Watching it felt at times like watching scenes I'd witness around town beat for beat, from the dialogue, "Fascists," one character yells when it appears the Durham Hotel has fumbled a booking, to the antics smoking weed atop the parking deck that overlooks the neon Old Bull sign, and soundtrack, "Why Oak, Big Thief." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Indie Week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Chris Canangla, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Indie Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.